This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, I'll throw money at Wagga, lots of it. They're the words of the former New South Wales Premier, revealed in phone tap evidence at the Independent Commission Against Corruption. Also, dozens more dead of COVID-19 in Victoria and still close to 2,000 new cases, just ahead of restrictions being further eased. So is the state moving too fast?
The reopening is too soon when you've got high circulating numbers each day. Certainly when New South Wales opened up, it was nowhere near that. And this is a problem.
And the government is not mandating it, but a beef farmer tells us cuts to methane are needed and consumers could force the change. But would the price of beef have to rise?
What I think we need to start thinking about is what a fair price for food is. And in my eyes, I think what we do need to do is think about how we reward farmers who are doing great work and encourage other farmers to kind of leap to the next threshold and make sure that their practices are more aligned with the social license that consumers are mandating from us.
Welcome to the program. Dramatic new evidence at the New South Wales Corruption Commission today. Phone intercepts revealed how the former Premier Gladys Berejiklian promised to overrule the bureaucrats and throw money at projects advanced by her former lover, the ex-state MP Darryl Maguire. The Independent Commission Against Corruption also probed the usually very private life of the pair as Mr Maguire gave his evidence in the investigation into whether Ms Berejiklian breached public trust or failed in her public duty to report corruption. The pair, we heard, was in love and contemplating marriage and one day having a child together. Nick Grimm reports.
Mr Maguire.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Ahead of Darryl Maguire's appearance in the witness box, lawyers for Gladys Berejiklian sought unsuccessfully to have details of his relationship with their client examined in a private hearing. But the romance she's previously characterised as having insufficient status to justify sharing with the world was more than a passing fancy, according to her former boyfriend.
Well, you contemplated marriage?
Yes.
With her?
Yes.
There was discussion about potentially having a child?
Yes.
Darryl Maguire is a man who admits his reputation precedes him, telling the ICAC he's often regarded in unflattering terms as a serial pest and possibly worse.
I think the term was pain in the ass. Yes.
You're prepared to adopt the pain in the ass term, is that right?
Yes, and vociferous.
And like others in the government, Gladys Berejiklian was given a taste of the famous Maguire pester power when it came to projects he was keen to advance in his electorate, as a phone intercept played to the hearing revealed.
We ticked off your conservatorium the other day, so that's a done deal now.
That's the building and $10 million, not the rest of it, not the next
page. Oh, my God. Heaven help us, seriously.
Anyway, that's all right. They'll all be happy with that.
Thank you for that.
In another phone intercept, Darryl Maguire regaled Ms Berejiklian with the charms of his hometown of Wagga Wagga.
Wagga's going to be the best electorate in the world. Keep listening to me and it'll be like the blazing star of the southern universe, I tell you.
Well, Wagga's just going to be like Sydney.
Correct. That's why we need a stadium. That's why we need a conservatorium. That's why we need the things that Sydney's got.
Mr Maguire resigned from the New South Wales Parliament in 2018 after admitting at a separate ICAC inquiry that he'd sought payment over a property deal. This inquiry is examining his efforts in helping secure millions of taxpayer dollars for privately owned projects in his Wagga electorate. It's against that backdrop that the investigation is seeking to determine whether Gladys Berejiklian breached public trust or turned a blind eye to corruption. And in the days that followed his resignation, ICAC intercepts of her phone conversations with Darryl Maguire reveal his continuing focus on securing money for his hometown.
I don't want to argue with you. I just need to go and chill because you've stressed
me out.
All
right, I'll go and chill. You just throw money at Wagga.
I'll throw money at Wagga. Don't you worry about that.
Just listen to me.
Lots of it.
That conversation continuing with this.
You just need to know what the right things are to throw money at Wagga.
And you I already know. You've already told me the three top things.
And you need to and go and give them a stadium. Give them a
stadium. I'll do that.
A stadium.
I'll do that too. Don't worry.
Well, the bureaucrats knocked it all out.
Yes, but I can overrule them anyway.
Earlier, the hearing was played another phone intercept of a conversation between Darryl Maguire and property developer William Leong about the route of a planned motorway in the vicinity of the developer's land interests in Western Sydney, the then MP acknowledging the commercially sensitive information was not yet publicly available.
Would I be able to have that map?
No, we couldn't possibly do that. That would be very wrong.
Even so, Darryl Maguire was able to pass on details of the route thanks to an unnamed friend.
Just let me work on this one now and we'll find out if we can help you.
The Commission heard that friend was a sitting member of the New South Wales Parliament. That person hasn't been identified. Counsel assisting the inquiry, Scott Robertson, putting this question to Darryl Maguire.
I take it you accept that by providing that information to Mr. Leong, you were misusing your position as a Member of Parliament?
A pause lasting almost 10 seconds followed, with Darryl Maguire eventually answering.
Well, yes.
Gladys Berejiklian is expected to give evidence tomorrow. She maintains she's done nothing wrong and that history will show she always put the interests of the people of her state ahead of all else.
Nick Grimm with that report. Well, a difficult day for the state of Victoria today. 25 more people have died with COVID alongside more than 1,900 new infections. Still, the state's hospitalisation rates remain stable. The vast majority of those in hospital are unvaccinated, while the state is also inching closer to key vaccination targets. But in New South Wales, 2 weeks after the easing of restrictions and warnings that case numbers and hospital pressure could spike, COVID case numbers are still relatively low. In Melbourne, Emily Burke reports.
The Delta outbreak has now claimed 272 lives in Victoria. 25 of them were reported today. It comes as the state prepares for a significant further easing of restrictions tomorrow night. And emergency doctor Stephen Parnas says hospitals are under pressure but not overwhelmed.
COVID is placing an immense burden on hospital services, but I do not think that we are at the point of saying that our ability to care for COVID patients is compromised by overwhelming numbers.
The hospitalisation rates are stable for now.
You know, days will look different to up and down over the course of the next couple of weeks.
Victoria's acting chief health officer is Ben Cowie.
We've got increased opening up and mixing of people. At the same time, we've got very, very high vaccination levels and increasing every day. So there are, at this sort of point where we are probably reaching a plateau, there's going to be a bit of churn around that. The modelling suggests that then we might see a slight reduction in case numbers, followed by a subsequent rise again through December and January.
For eligible Victorians aged over 16, more than three quarters are fully vaccinated and 92% have had their first dose. As Victoria reaches its 80% double dose vaccination target, Melburnians will be able to travel to regional Victoria from 6 p.m. tomorrow. But some people are going to great lengths to avoid being vaccinated at all, including abusing or attempting to bribe doctors.
There have been reports of people going from general practice to try and get different outcomes.
Professor Cowie says those seeking an exemption will need new paperwork.
Only the Australian Immunisation Register medical exemption form is to be used to provide patients proof of medical exemption to any vaccination requirements in Victoria.
The Premier has also defended the vaccine mandates that are required across a broad range of industries, services, workers, clients and customers.
We would not be at these vaccination levels if we had not mandated vaccines in lots of different areas. We'd be locked down still. We wouldn't be going to 80% tomorrow night and having a long weekend.
The reopening is too soon when you've got high circulating numbers each day that is over 1,000. Certainly when New South Wales opened up, it was nowhere near that. And this is a problem.
Epidemiologist and infectious diseases expert, Professor Mary Louise McClaws.
I know that you're itching to open up, but if you're going to, you really do need to wear masks outdoors, regardless of who you are, because your vaccination rate across total population is only 60%. So not quite one in two people who meet each other in the street may not be vaccinated.
By contrast, New South Wales recorded fewer than 300 cases in the latest reporting period.
the testing rates in New South Wales have dropped dramatically.
So do you think there might be more cases circulating, but they're just not being picked up because the testing rates have fallen away?
There's likely to be more cases, given that we've had a drop from nearly 186,000 tests at the peak of testing down to only 71,000 tests. So we should be doing more testing with the rapid antigen test kits. It is a way of knowing whether or not our vaccination level has reduced the circulation of the virus.
Professor Mary Louise McClaws, Emily Burke with that report. Well, loud arguments in federal parliament today after a revelation that the modelling for the government's net zero by 2050 plan, while complete, is yet to be put into comprehensible form. A senior industry department official gave the details during a Senate Estimates Committee hearing, and it was seized on by the opposition after observers had earlier noted the plan came with no modelling on its release yesterday. The Prime Minister battered back that the modelling would soon be released. But the real fuss today has been about the government's decision, with opposition backing, to exclude methane from the net zero climate target and to reject a global push to slash methane emissions. Gavin Coote reports.
The Prime Minister's off to Glasgow with a 2050 net zero emissions policy, and his deputy, Barnaby Joyce, is hailing a decision to leave agriculture out of the crossfire.
We heard what has been happening in Glasgow and the movements that have been made by the President of the United States and others towards a methane target by 2030 on 2020 levels, 30% reduction. And I'm so happy and confident that that's not a path that Australia will entertain.
The Nationals are claiming credit for the Morrison government's decision not to sign up to a global goal for cutting methane emissions. And Labor is also on board with that. Its energy spokesman Chris Bowen says there are other ways to go about it.
What we're calling on the government to do is to work with agriculture, to work with farmers to reduce methane emissions, to work cooperatively with the agriculture sector.
Methane from livestock accounts for about 10% of Australia's emissions. And the peak body, the National Farmers Federation, has also pushed back against the idea of further regulating it. Joshua Gilbert is a Worimi man and fourth-generation cattle farmer based on the mid-north coast of New South Wales.
I think what agriculture has done really in the last 5-6 years is prepare itself for these conversations. The Meat and Livestock Association, for instance, has got a carbon neutral target by 2030. We know that agriculture more broadly has been looking at this space, particularly in terms of methane and other emissions. I think farmers are really ready to step up and do our fair share.
What does this mean at the consumer level? Because if we have the technology, or the technology is potentially coming with helping get methane emissions down, the cost of adopting that technology, would that be passed on to the consumer? And I guess simply, will we be paying more for meat?
I think for me, the conversation's probably got to develop a little bit further than just thinking about, you know, paying more for meat. What I think we need to start thinking about is what a fair price for food is. Just the loss of arable land due to climate change, for instance, is going to be an important factor. So we know that it's going to be harder to produce food. So there is quite a lot of opportunities, but what we need to start thinking about is how we start paying a fair price for food. And in my eyes, I think what we do need to do is think about how we reward farmers who are doing great work and encourage other farmers to kind of leap to the next threshold and make sure that their practices are more aligned with the social license that consumers are mandating from us.
And while Australia's rejected the pledge outright, New Zealand has indicated it may join the dozens of other countries looking to cut methane emissions. The NZ government says it's actively considering signing up to the pledge and will make a decision soon. But it's also facing pushback from farmers there.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the only thing keeping the lights on in the country at the moment. You know, tourism and agriculture are our two main sort of money earners in the world, and tourism's been pretty much killed thanks to COVID. So all we've got left's really agriculture.
Andrew Hoggard is the national president for Federated Farmers New Zealand.
Okay, how are we going to produce food at the least impact possible whilst still maintaining food production? Because can't afford to have, you know, large chunks of the planet going hungry, and we need the nutrition, but we've got to do it in the lowest footprint.
Do you see there being a path forward for reducing emissions without having an impact on agricultural production in New Zealand?
I think we can make gains in agriculture. There's various bits of technology that, you know, we're expecting to be available to us, feed additives that can reduce the methane from the from rumens by up to 30%. But it's not here, it's not now. And if we go and just say, oh, well, let's drop our production here in New Zealand by 10%, just to make these greenhouse gas reductions, then, you know, in the world, you know, someone else is going to have to produce that food. Doesn't actually make a lot of sense from a global warming point of view.
Andrew Hoggard from Federated Farmers New Zealand, Gavin Coote with that report. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the podcast and on the ABC Listen app. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, famine is the latest threat to the people of Afghanistan, but amid images of emaciated and dying children, the US continues to deny the ruling Taliban access to financial reserves. So what's going to break that stalemate?
What's going to break it is these pictures, not just the pictures, but the reality of the famine. I think it's one thing for the U.S. to play this game with it, the leverage that it has over the Taliban, but they're trying to extract something in return. And frankly, there's going to be incredible pressure on the United States.
It's almost 2 weeks since Cleo Smith disappeared from a campsite in Western Australia, and people from her hometown of Carnarvon are gathering this evening for a vigil. Around 100 officers are still searching for the four-year-old. Today, the detective in charge of the massive operation has travelled to the scene of the crime. Our reporter Matt Bamford has been keeping across the developments.
Detective Superintendent Rod Wild flew up to Carnarvon from Perth today to visit the campsite where Leo was last seen. He's been coordinating this huge operation that now has been given additional assistance from the Australian Federal Police. Exactly what they're offering is not being discussed right now, but perhaps that'll become clearer in time. In terms of the steps police have been taking in recent days, they've conducted a second search of the family's home in Carnarvon, although police were careful to point out that this was standard practice and the family have not been named as suspects. They've also canvassed businesses in the town's industrial estate looking for more CCTV footage, and forensic teams have taken soil samples at the campfires around the Blowholes campsite. Investigators are still trying to find out more about a vehicle that left the site around 3 a.m. on the morning Cleo went missing. They have some CCTV footage, but they need more information. Mm. There was some discussion that the detective superintendent was going to address the media. He's yet to do that, but he did tell reporters when he got off the plane that he was confident this case can be solved.
So how's the community responding?
Well, it's important to remember that Carnarvon is a really small town, less than 5,000 people, so it's a fairly tight-knit community. A vigil is being held this evening at the St. Mary Star of the Sea Catholic Church, which is attached to the school that she attended. It's being seen as a chance for the community to come together and reflect and pray and show their support for the family and for each other. I spoke with Father Steve Casey, who organised the event, and he told me that everyone is welcome, whether they're religious or not. It's just an opportunity to give these people some space to process their emotions. He said it's an act of hope, not despair, and that it's important to maintain faith that Cleo will be returned to her family.
Here are these things happening in other places, but when it happens here, it really rocks everybody to their core. And I guess people just feel the need to talk about it with each other and just to hug each other and say how they're feeling, because we obviously don't have the answers.
Father Steve Casey in Carnarvon there. Matt, what's the mood of the community? I mean, we heard a bit of that from Father Steve there, but, you know, it must be very difficult for people to keep emotions in check and also to keep hopes up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a quiet community that relies on tourism and agriculture. The pace of life is very much slower. But in some respects, this has really galvanised some people. We know that there have been lots of volunteers helping in the search, and there's a lot of goodwill being spread around town at the moment. I spoke to Tom Day, who's a banana grower in Carnarvon. He said that despite the terrible circumstances, he's never seen people in the town come together like this before.
I mean, there are people talking to one another that have probably never seen each other before, and, you know, they're all getting behind it. It's a common effort being made by everybody, and it sort of makes you proud that you live in a community where everyone pulls together when you need something like this to happen.
Carnarvon resident Tom Day, Matt Bamford, our reporter there. Well, images of emaciated, malnourished children continue to emerge from Afghanistan, with the World Food Programme estimating that nearly 23 million of the country's 39 million people cannot get access to enough food, and that what is coming is widespread famine. The BBC this week documented the story of one family that has sold their baby daughter just to keep food on the table. Radio Free Europe has reported that 8 orphaned children were found dead of starvation in the capital, Kabul. They were said to be aged from 8 years to 18 months. Aid agencies are pleading for more international funding to help, with the WFP saying as it stands it'll run out of money for Afghanistan before December, while the situation is intensifying pressure on the US for continuing to block Taliban access to the country's financial reserves. Well, Professor Jen Brick-Mirtazashvili is a governance, security and development expert at the University of Pittsburgh.
One of the concerns is that the entire rural area has been living with this kind of instability for a very long time. But now this is also hitting communities in urban areas and children in urban areas that are not used to this, that don't necessarily have the resilience to manage this. And this is largely because government salaries aren't being paid and those people in the cities aren't getting salaries. And so you're seeing this affect a much wider swath of the population than we saw earlier from the insurgency and that very localized violence that cut people off from food and assistance.
So what's happened to paying work in Afghanistan? Why are people not getting salaries?
People don't have salaries because the government has no money. And the government has no money because the U.S. controls the keys to the bank. And after the collapse of the government, the U.S. Froze all of the central bank's assets. And this was for a couple of reasons. I think the first reason was to prevent the government officials who were fleeing from taking that money with them. And remember, there were these reports that President Ashraf Ghani left the country with $169 million in cash or something like this. And there were bags of cash being squandered out of the country. But then the other concern is now with this uncertain regime that's in control of the country, that they won't be good stewards of those resources. And of course, that the U.S. still has designated the Taliban as a terrorist organization. We can't necessarily have U.S. taxpayer dollars in the hands of the Taliban.
There has been talk about finding creative ways to get money to areas of need, to other organisations, and bypassing the Taliban. Has there been any real progress on that sort of thing?
There has been at the individual level. So we have, aid organisations who are bringing in food aid directly. So this is one way to do it. So you're not dealing with money, but you're dealing with aid and assistance. But of course, a lot of that's going to have to go through Taliban hands. But another way to do it is through the informal finance system, things like the Hawala system, as it's called. And this informal finance system allows people to transfer cash from overseas into Afghanistan. And it's a historic system. It actually exists throughout the Muslim world, but it is used quite a lot inside of Afghanistan and allows people to circumvent the government. But on the other hand, it's a very difficult thing to scale at such a large level.
So what is the answer? And has there been any progress? We saw some US Taliban talks a little while back. Is there anything emerging that might sort of break this stalemate over the money?
Well, I think what's going to break it is these pictures. Right? Is not just the pictures, but the reality of the famine. I think it's one thing for the U.S. to play this game with the leverage that it has over the Taliban, but they're trying to extract something in return. And frankly, the United States just doesn't have a lot of leverage, especially as these pictures become worse and worse coming out of the country. There's going to be incredible pressure on the United States, I think, to release some of those resources. Neighboring countries are calling on the U.S. to do so, not necessarily to engage the Taliban or recognize the government, but to allow some of those resources to flow back into the country, because also neighboring countries fear instability as well flowing out of their country. So the United States is really, in Europe, they remain sort of outliers at this point on that. And so I think the pressure will only continue.
We've seen a couple of meetings, one just this week, of regional countries, neighbouring countries, China, Iran, Pakistan, Russia. Are they concerned about the famine, the food situation? Are they taking any action?
Yes, other countries have contributed food aid. They've contributed medicine. I think some have even contributed vaccines. The Gulf states have contributed resources. But of course, it's not significant amounts of money. compared to what the U.S. was providing. So let's just remind ourselves that the U.S. was providing 70% of the country's budget. I mean, it was such a vast amount of money that was coming into the country from the United States. And even if the U.S. does allow that money to flow back into the country, you're not going to replace the vast amounts of aid that came in. This was the real problem with what the U.S. built inside of Afghanistan, was something just completely dependent on foreign assistance.
Jennifer Brick Mirtazashvili, thank you very much for your time today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And Professor Mirtazashvili is from the University of Pittsburgh. Well, back home, there are warnings that the cost of borrowing and rents are on the way up and much faster than has been forecast. In the past 2 weeks, all four big banks have quietly raised their fixed mortgage rates. The NAB was the last to move yesterday. Rents, too, are now rising at their fastest pace since the global financial crisis. So millions of households are being told to prepare for a squeeze in coming years. Business reporter David Taylor.
44-year-old Melbourne-based Chris Richmond is in a bit of a pickle. Delays in renovating his home means he's now both renting and paying off a mortgage.
Yeah, it's been a really challenging time to try to figure out where to live and paying that extra rent, and having three kids and a dog to move around all the time is not fun.
A big chunk of his mortgage repayments are fixed. He says he's okay now, but he knows in a few years' time he'll need to budget for much higher mortgage repayments.
You've got to be a bit of a student of history. These things can happen. Like, I think people just have their head in the sand about assets like houses being going the other way. So, you know, it's a dangerous game to play.
Interest rates are already rising, and quite steeply in some cases, by as much as a third of a percentage point. RateCity is an interest rate comparison website. Director of Research, Sally Tyndall, says all four big banks have again moved in unison and hiked their fixed rate mortgage products over the past 10 days.
What that means is anyone going for a home loan that's 2 years or longer might have to pay a little bit more as a result.
The cost of most fixed-rate mortgages are largely determined by changes in overseas interest rates, which are rising steadily, especially in the US. And while this week's changes to 2 to 5 year term fixed-rate mortgages won't affect borrowers already locked into contracts, banking analyst Martin North says millions of those borrowers are in for a rude shock down the track.
Yeah, this is a really big deal. In my surveys, a lot of people have automatically assume that they will be able to roll over at the current rates again. Not true, it'll be higher. That means it's going to have a significant pressure on some of those households.
Borrowers can take steps, though, says Sally Tyndall, to put themselves in a better financial position.
Variable rates are coming down. There's a lot of competition in this space at the moment. You can use that to your advantage by potentially refinancing your home loan to a better deal. Variable rates can rise. However, they do have extra flexibility.
But analyst Martin North cautions borrowers to think carefully about mortgage products the banks push their way. He says financial markets and several major Australian banks are now also preparing for the Reserve Bank, which sets variable rates, to hike its cash rate as early as next year. He warns banks are now ushering more borrowers into their variable rate products in anticipation of a series of RBA rate hikes.
What that means is that they are now taking out their own insurance policies. So if rates move up faster, they can put those mortgage rates up faster, whereas, of course, with the fixed rates, essentially they've locked themselves in.
But with property ownership now out of reach for many younger Australians, is it better to rent? Well, CoreLogic's latest quarterly rental review shows national rental rates are now rising at their fastest annual pace since 2008. Head of research, Eliza Owen.
Ideally, it wouldn't be down to the individual to get these handy tips and tricks. There would be a stronger institutional response to provide long-term affordable rental accommodation for those who might not be able to buy into the property market.
Rubbing salt into the wound for renters is rock-bottom interest rates on bank deposit accounts. RateCity's Sally Tyndall says all four big banks have lowered their deposit rates over the past 6 weeks to dismal levels. She says you simply have to shop around.
ING is offering the highest ongoing savings rate of 1.35%, whereas Westpac, they're offering young Australians aged between 18 and 29 at 2.5%, which is a pretty good deal in this climate.
The lowest deposit rate is currently 0.05%. With fees and charges, you might be better putting your hard-earned cash under the mattress.
Business reporter David Taylor, and that's PM for this Thursday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. More PM for you tomorrow with David Lipson in the chair. Hope you'll join him then.
Hi, I'm Angela Boispierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
The next 2 and a bit weeks of the COP26 summit in Glasgow could decide a lot about what kind of world we end up living in, specifically whether it's 1.5, 2, 3 or even 4 degrees warmer.
Today on The Signal, are we currently on track? And days out from the start of the conference, what should we realistically expect it to achieve? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.